just wanted to welcome you to this session, the labor of mergers and acquisitions, how labor and business archivists can work together. This session was envisioned as a roundtable discussion. So what you're going to hear today is this isn't going to be formal paper presentations of in-depth research that we've all done, although we do work with these issues and have thought about them a great deal. This is going to be a panel of people who deal with this issue, who work with this issue, and who have the responsibility to handle these issues, give comments about it. But hopefully what we were envisioning was that audience members will stimulate discussion as well, and that we could, as best we can, have a dialogue in the next 2 hours about these issues. My name is Lauren Cada. I'm currently serving as a contract archivist with a private engineering firm. But prior to that, I was the archivist for the Southern Labor Archives at Georgia State University in their Special Collections Department, and worked at the Reuther Library's Archives of Labor and Urban Affairs. So I'm interested in this because I had to deal with it specifically as an archivist working with labor union records and also some business employee records as well. But what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk a little bit, give a little bit of an introduction and a context, and then I'm going to hand over this microphone, and we have microphones here, and each of our panelists are going to kind of give a 5 to 10 minute presentation on what they see are the issues, and then our discussion is going to be stimulated that way. So thank you for coming, and please think of ideas and comments that you have, and I'd ask that if you'd like to speak about them, let's have a dialogue today. I think the role of archives and archivists in mergers and acquisitions is particularly relevant to labor and business sections and business archivists because of the frequency with which mergers and acquisitions take place. But I also believe that issues such as organizational identity and maintaining provenance of records, and of course a shared concern over eventual destruction of records, binds all archivists together in this issue. But there are some specific concerns for labor records, that is, records of organizations, not just unions, but umbrella organizations, before, during, and after mergers. And I think that as archivists, we have responsibility to address those. Labor archivists through the Society of American Archivists Labor Archives Roundtable and on an individual basis have struggled with these concerns for several years, discussed them, and there never seems to be any easy answers, which is why we're here today. I think that, labor archives and business archives have a potential to learn from each other with this regard. We tried to get together in February of 2006 to crunch out some of these issues, we being the small group of labor archivists. And the mergers discussion that we had, I think, we didn't have any easy answers, but one of the questions that came out was, okay, I know traditionally that, we're not meeting with the business archivists, but how do they do it? And how do corporate archivists deal with mergers and acquisitions? And is there something to be learned from their best practices? And what are the concerns about that? So to set a context, before I hand over the microphone to our next speaker, I wanted just to say, I take for granted what I mean by merger, but when I first started as a labor archivist, which had, over 20,000 feet of labor union records, I had to become familiar with all the different unions who we collected at the Southern Labor Archives. It's the entire southeast region of labor organizations are the collections there. And one of the collections we had was the Union of Needleworks Industrial Textile Employees and Hotel and Restaurant Employees Unions. We had their Southern Regional Collection. And as we got through the records and started getting to know them and had to deal with them for reference, and we also had to work with the donors, we began to learn that I learned that, you know, the history of the union, there are several organizations that came together to make that union what it is today. So Unite Here, as it is today, originally there was the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and then the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Association. There's the Textile Workers Union of America. There's also the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. And then in the 70s, they merged to make the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. And anyway, it can get very confusing. And, you know, today the union is the Unite Here Union. And who knows what the landscape is going to produce in the next decade. So anyways, thank you. And I'm interested in your ideas and your comments and your feedback. And I'm going to hand the microphone over to Jim.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Quigley, and I'm head of historical collections and labor archives at the Pennsylvania State University. Among our labor collections, we're the flagship collection repository for the United Steelworkers of America, who've recently changed their name, and that'll be part of the story today, and the United Mine Workers, along with other labor records, including the State Federation of Pennsylvania. This has been an issue that's been very close to my heart for a number of years, and I've devoted quite a bit of research to it and still trying to get the figure of the landscape. So I think I'm going to probably set the table and then redress some other issues and have the other participants discuss a lot of those issues and get back to that. But I think it helps a little bit to look at what we're sort of dealing with here in the landscape, and I've devoted a lot of attention to that. And a lot of it is just being part of the practical work experience and nothing theoretical. It's just trying to deal with this issue on a daily basis as an archivist. I was sort of put in the frying pan as the archivist of the International Union of Electrical Workers at Rutgers. As I was getting ready to leave that job and transitioning to my new job at Penn State, we got rumors of potential merger with the IUE. It was an election year, and a very fractious election year between the two candidates. And the merger issue came up as a political issue, but like war, truth is the first casualty in merger negotiations. So as I was leaving IU, the IUE program at Rutgers, I kept thinking, wow, I really dodged the bullet with that. I would not want to deal with that issue. And then I got myself in the frying pan, because then there were rumors that the IUE was having discussion merger talks with the United Mine Workers, and I was just moving into an even worse situation. So by the time I got there, it got even more muddled, because what eventually happened was that the IUE was absorbed by the communication workers. They're now a division with the CWA. My predecessor, I believe they got another 5 years of funding. It was a union finance program. They provided the archivist salary at Rutgers. So it was a division within the IUE. The IUE was a division within the communication workers. So they still held a lot of administrative control over their records, and things went on until the past year when it became a full-fledged division within the communication workers, and they dropped their support for the program and still sorting out what's going on with the CWA, and assuming that the IUE records are now, as a division, going to the CWA archives, or they worked out some arrangement. In addition, the union that I now represent, or our client union at Penn State, the United Steelworkers of America, is sort of representative of the landscape that we're looking at, particularly with industrial unions, globalization issues, deindustrialization, membership losses, a very hostile environment to organizing. A lot of unions are looking towards merger activities as self-survival. And it's just not small unions, the larger unions that are doing this. The landscape is even more muddled now with the rise of a rival federation, the Change to Win. Started out as the New Unity Partnership, the Coalition to Win, and now Change to Win. And among the five member unions, they have pledged a statement to increasing activity on the consolidation front. The idea is to leverage resources and membership campaigns and more coordinated bargaining and strategic bargaining on a global level with global corporations. And in order to do this, they're talking about consolidating into 15 and 20 sectors. To just give you an example, the penultimate merger was the AFL-CIO in 1955. You had over 135 affiliated unions. The AFL-CIO is now down to 55 members, minus the five in the Change to Win. And even within the AFL CIO, the steelworkers did not bolt and go over to the Change the Wind coalition. But since 1993, they've been involved in 8 mergers. Now, granted, some of those are smaller independent unions and Canadian branches of other unions that have been absorbed by the AFL. But among these are some pretty heavyweight or one-time heavyweight CIO unions, the Union United Rubber Workers, the Aluminum Brick and Glass Workers, the American Flint Gas Workers, and recently PACE, which itself was a product of a merger in 1999 between the United Paper Workers International and the Oil Chemical Workers. So you can see this really, really gets muddled. But in the short front, what's happening is you're getting larger unions, and the frequency is becoming even higher. One of the initiatives that I undertook was sort of a survey in 2001, 2002, before Birmingham, and it was a mixed bag survey. It was just to try to figure out what the lay of the land was, and it really is a mixed bag. We found that the issue of mergers was a pretty important thing among the larger institutions because they were getting the immediate impact, less of a concern to the smaller unions that weren't collecting enough in the area to have much of an impact. And what was happening is that it was not sort of a blip on the screen, but over the last 7 years, it's emerged as a real, real hot button issue because our archival programs are being impacted of this, particularly on the legal front. And again, it's a very fluid situation. Not all repositories have the same arrangement for collecting with their client or donating unions. It's a real big issue because some repositories where labor is the primary collecting focus, they may have an infrastructure, a pipeline to the unions, and they may be able to handle this a lot better. Areas like where I work, where labor is a significant part of our program but not the main part of the program, we may not be as connected with the labor unions, a little bit out of the mainstream with that, to be able to handle the impact. It's a very muddled situation, particularly with regard to the legal agreements, if we do have those in place, of just what are we obligated to collect. We were not prepared to plan ahead to figure out this merger landscape. All of a sudden, you know, you could be faced with the prospect of being obligated to collect several thousand feet of records that you hadn't planned for. And are we in a position to do this, and how do we negotiate with our particular unions? So it's a very, very muddled area, and I think anyone coming today for really hardcore prescriptions is going to be a little bit disappointed. We're just trying to figure out the lay of the land and go about it as we can. I do think from what I've seen from the survey results, that those places that really do have connections with the union institutionally, principally largely in urban areas where there's a big center for this, for the labor studies, and they're well situated, with a records management program, they're better equipped to sort of handle this. The rest of the institutions are grappling with this. And again, the impact may not be immediate. I kind of liken it to a pig in the python theory, that these unions now are ingesting these records, but it may take several years before it really, really hits us, because just trying to even follow the elusive paper trail of where records go, there's an enormous amount of local and district records being lost, particularly among smaller unions, because by the time we're notified that an agreement has been made, and it may take years before the administrative structures are resolved within the institutional arrangements for the merger, and it's a bewildering way of arrangements. Some of these old unions become divisions, conference boards, coordinating bargaining committees, industrial sectors, whatever typology or nomenclature you want to use. It can be very confusing, but somehow records have to be collected by the ongoing organization. The question is, what happens to those historical records? Where do they go? With the idea of leveraging resources, it's supporting two different archival programs could become relatively expensive, particularly for the absorbed union. But there are possibilities where there could be logic and rationale for maintaining two programs if the absorbed partner has the resources to do that. I drafted some guidelines for discussion, but I think I'll save those to the end about an action program that we can follow up, and I'll turn it over to the rest of the panel.
Okay. I'll use this one here. I think it's on. There you go. This is working. Everyone can hear me? Okay, thank you. My name is Mike Smith. I'm director of the Walter Reuther Library at Wayne State University in Detroit and former colleague of Lauren Cato. And I would like to thank Lauren for not asking us to provide anything in the way of answers, just ideas. Because as we were talking earlier before the panel, there is no model for handling mergers, and we've all been pretty much flying by the seat of our pants. Now, as Jim has pointed out, the current labor situation in this country has affected all of us. The labor movement has shrunk, therefore membership has been drastically reduced, which means union dues are drastically reduced, which means financial resources for what is usually the low priority for unions, archives, have been drastically reduced. Another factor that mitigates all of this is labor history itself is no longer the hot field that it was in the 60s and 70s. Though I would argue that, and have argued, that there are a number of research avenues yet unexplored in our union collections. I won't say much more about the labor situation. I think we all know what it is. But I will give you an axiom at this point that is ironclad, and this will be no revolution to any, or revelation to any of you. Everything we talk about is mitigated by two things, space and money. And this has a large effect on our situation. There's another factor, too, I think we need to consider, at least I've considered, is the precedent was set for all of us here in the 60s and 70s, when labor archives were first established, when collections were first collected, when our relationships with the unions were initiated. That has sort of set a pattern that all of us as directors of archives deal with today. At the Reuther, for example, we have 13 unions that we collect, 13 unions still operating that we are the official repository for, and a rather wide range. I guess the last one we added was in 97, the National Association of Letter Carriers. So we have taken on an extra union recently, and the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away Employees is another one we added just a couple of years ago. But generally speaking, our collections came to us in the 60s and 70s when there was a whole different situation for the labor movement. And in thinking about the differences of working with labor unions, I guess I'd like to throw out just a couple of personal experiences and personal philosophies on this. Again, there's no model for mergers. Indeed, often labor archivists are the last to know that a union is merging with another union. Also, one thing that you always have to keep in mind when you're dealing with the labor unions is everything is political. Everything is political. Now, I'm not saying that's much different from a corporation. Every institution has its political culture. But everything is really political, and it means that we as archivists have to be, at the very least, cognizant of those politics. I'll give you a prime example for the Reuther Library, is when Change to Win was formed 2 years ago, as Jim mentioned, which was the first new labor federation since the merger of the AFL-CIO in 55, or if you look at it a different way, the first major different federation since the CIO was formed in 1935. And this means that for us, we had collections on both sides of the divide. We have AFSCME, our prime donor is the United Automobile Workers, American Federation of Teachers, which of course stayed with the AFL-CIO, as well as we have the Service Employees International Union, which was the prime backer and prime instigator, catalyst, however you picture it, for the Change to Win Federation, the formation of that. And the farm workers, which we all also collect, the United Farm Workers, of course, jumped to Change to Win. So we definitely have to be neutral as much as we can, but we've got competing factors there, and each side, of course, has suspicions about the other side at this point. And it makes some delicate treading for me as director of the Reuther.
I think so far, the way we've dealt with mergers has been quite informal. Again, I don't think we have a real model, but what we have is something that is relatively decentralized. In one way, it's centralized. The United Automobile Workers, for example, it's our charge at the Reuther Library to be responsible for their historical records. But on the other hand, there's no way for us to collect every local, and I'm not sure that we should collect every local. For example, Richard Strasberg from Cornell called me up a couple years ago, and this is the way it's worked, and said, hey, there's a UAW local that's in our area that we'd like to preserve its records. Well, that made all the sense in the world. I appreciated the call, appreciated the heads up on it, and what can we do to help you with it? At least we're still cognizant of it. Same thing with Jim. He's taken in an SEIU local in Pennsylvania, which makes sense. And as long as we can cooperate together, then I can still talk to Andy Stern, the president of SEIU, and say, yes, I know what's going on in Pennsylvania. Other aspects are kind of interesting. For example, we have the Airline Pilots Association and the American Flight Association of Flight Attendants, which was part of the Airline Pilots Association for many years until all of a sudden it jumped ship to the Communication Workers of America, which are in Michael's shop in New York City. And we have sort of taken the tact that let sleeping dogs lie. We are maintaining the records for the flight attendants. We are providing service and retrieval. Yet we know it someday, you know, that ultimately the control over the records, because we do not own any records from unions at the Reuther. We have deposit agreements. Ultimately, someday Michael may call and say, hey, the powers that be, say, shift the flight attendants over to our shop. Another aspect about mergers that I find interesting is, for example, the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away employees. This is a Detroit-based union. They had 300 boxes of their history sitting in an unheated, uncooled storage facility on 8 Mile in Detroit that was just sitting there. And the only reason they acted on it is because they were about to become a consul of the Brotherhood of Teamsters. And they wanted to preserve their history as it was before they merged into this larger organization. This, of course, was very good for us. And I think it speaks to, too, with some of the, to the point that some of these smaller unions want to preserve their heritage. And one way of doing it is to have this collection sort of a finite collection now deposited. A couple thoughts I have that I'll conclude with on this is, one is, do we need to collect beyond what we have? As Jim mentioned, there's 55 unions still in the AFL-CIO. If you go down that list, most of the major unions, I would say all the major unions, in terms of heritage, in terms of membership, they're already in one of our shops. And being cared for. And we may take on some of the smaller unions as they merge, but that may suffice to document the labor movement as we know it now. I also think we need more of a move towards decentralization rather than centralization, again, using UAW as a factor. There's no way that at the Reuther Library we can control all aspects of the heritage of the UAW effectively. Control their records effectively without help from other labor archives around the country. I think that communication is going to be key in the future, and I have great hopes that the Labor Archives Roundtable, sessions like this, will lead to further communication between those of us who collect labor records. And while there are only a few archives that concentrate on labor history, most labor records are actually in smaller archives that have many missions, as Jim was pointing out again. Indeed, at the Reuther, we still have another mission, which is urban affairs in modern Detroit. But I think that communication and maybe providing some sort of general guidelines would be helpful. I don't think we can put any kind of mandate out from SAA or any organization that's really going to affect, this, Jim may disagree with me on this later, that's going to affect the political situation with the unions and the way we have to operate. And one last thought I'll toss out there is that with the onslaught of electronic records, digital records, and we all know what we're all trying to cope with it now, It's a great thing for archives. It's a great crisis for archives. But with the way the current communication is between unions and by unions, I think we also need to think about documenting the labor movement as much as just collecting the labor movement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I'm Michael Nash, the director of the Tavenman Library and Robert F. Wagner Labor Archives at NYU. Before that, I was chief curator of library collections at the Hagley Museum and Library, which is a business archive repository. And I was also an archives consultant at Bank of America for 10 years. And for this session, I'm actually putting back my hat on as a business archivist, and I want to sort of focus on the case study of Bank of America, which absorbed MBNA in January of 2006. And at that point, when Bank of America absorbed the MBNA archives, we were faced with the question of what was going to happen to the MBNA archives. Maureen Quimby, who worked with me for most of this period, is in the audience in the third row, and she sort of lived with this experience probably more directly than I, because she worked there and I was the consultant. There were sort of a number of questions that are immediately came to mind at this point of merger. I mean, initially we perceived that there clearly was going to be a tension between what the business needs of Bank of America were for this archive and how we considered sort of the best practice, best archival practice, and how we sort of juggled them and tried to resolve them was sort of an ongoing story that went on for about 18 months. The other thing you need to remember, this is clearly an in-house corporate archive. So the paramount needs were what was going to be the business need for the archive for the Bank of America, the acquiring corporation. And while we all recognized that we really wanted to maintain the integrity of the archive, that needed to be considered in light of the business needs of Bank of America, because unless that was addressed, the operation wasn't going to continue. And like the rest of our presenters, I'm very reluctant to make any overarching claims based on this one case study, but I just want to sort of share with you what we did and what we our goals and objectives were. As I said, given the realization that we needed to address what the business needs of Bank of America were for the archive, you know, the first question that we had to grapple with was the fact that we had assembled an archive which was somewhat in excess of 5,000 linear feet. And one of the things we needed to focus on was reappraisal. Out of this 5,000 linear feet, which was obviously an archive that was created in light of the way we perceived the business needs of MBNA, how did that change after the merger? What did Bank of America hope to get from this archive, which had to be thought about and within the larger question of why they acquired MBNA? That was actually the first set of questions we asked ourselves as we were thinking about reappraising the archive. What portion of this archive was going to be an asset to Bank of America? And that needed to be the focus of our reappraisal. And that sort of turned us to the question of why did Bank of America require MBNA? And there were several reasons. One was the their expertise in technology. The other was their expertise in affinity group marketing. And let me sort of backtrack. Yeah, sometimes when you're sort of inside the corporation, you sort of tend to talk in lingo. But you probably all, anybody who's bought a credit card probably knows what we mean by affinity group marketing. It's marketing credit cards to people with a common interest, whether they're a New York Yankee fan or a bird watcher or somebody who's interested in NASCAR racing. And that was, what built the MBNA credit card operation is their success in affinity marketing. And that was sort of one of the reasons why Bank of America acquired the corporation. So it was that, that was one of the assets that we sought to preserve within the Bank of America, in the new Bank of America archive, because we thought that it would be clearly useful to the new entity. As you all know, Bank of America now advertises itself as the bank of baseball. And so the records documenting the relationship between the old entity, MBNA, and Major League Baseball and all the other sports, major, minor league, and peewee league was seen actually by the people at corporate headquarters as an asset. At least that was our perception. So that was part of what we sought to preserve. Other areas, I want to sort of go through this very quickly because we have limited time. Bank of America had particular expert in technology, customer satisfaction. Market research was another area where there were clearly assets that needed to be preserved. So as we reappraised the archive, these were areas that we were particularly interested in making sure was saved. And I want to sort of reemphasize the context, because this is very similar to what Mike said. Space and resources are key, I think, to any operation, particularly the point of merger. Because there was some discussion, and candidly, I don't know how this is all going to turn out, because this is still a work in progress, about moving the archives down to Charlotte, which was the corporate headquarters. At least when we first got started, that seemed to be what was going to happen. So the question was, how much of this archive could be moved to Charlotte, and how much of it should be moved to Charlotte? The other thing we needed to think about was obviously the legal implications of all of this. One of the things that archivists obviously need to be very conscious of, particularly in the post-Enron era and the Sarbanes-Oxley law, is when we schedule records for destruction, there's certain guidelines that we need to adhere to be in compliance with Sarbanes-Oxley, and typically in terms of areas relating to stockholder relations, finance in particular, to a lesser degree to political action. This was something else that we were very conscious of as we were reappraising this archive, we were shredding material that we really decided was out of scope. But obviously, when you get involved with this kind of destruction in a corporate setting, you've got to be very, very, very careful in order to maintain compliance, both with the government regulations, and also thinking about the legal implications of what you're doing in terms of ongoing litigation. On the labor side, if I could put that hat back on, obviously it's the Landrum-Griffin Act that we need to think about if we're going to engage in this type of destruction or deaccessioning, because increasingly, particularly in the new more hostile labor environment, the Bush Labor Department is sort of enforcing those regulations, quite carefully and more vigorously than before. In terms of material, I just want to go very, very quickly. The other area that we were very careful with was records relating to risk management, because clearly that has implications in terms of the regulatory environment. Records that perhaps had less interest to the new entity, those that were clearly related to sort of more local concerns, their local charitable relationships, the MBNA Foundation, buildings that the bank had gotten rid of at the point of merger. Clearly, these were easy decisions. They were things that clearly were not going to be an asset. A more complicated situation was records relating to corporate culture. One of the things that we were doing with the MBNA archives, MBNA had a very entrepreneurial corporate culture. It was obviously it was a credit card company that grew up in the 80s, expanded very rapidly under the influence of its CEO Charlie Cawley, and entrepreneurial ethic was very important. Bank of America, actually, as a much older institution, is a much more bureaucratic organization, and there seemed to be less reason to preserve this evidence of the entrepreneurial corporate culture at MBNA, which is largely irrelevant to the logic company. I'm not saying that we deaccessioned all material relating to the corporate culture, but that was actually a very heavy emphasis on what we did in the archive, which seemed less relevant to Bank of America. Sum up, because this case, which I expect is from what I've heard from some of my other colleagues who have gone through similar exercise in the corporate sector, that the two issues that we really needed to think about is what was important to the acquiring entity, and what we were, and doing what we did to stay in compliance with the legal imperatives and also the regulatory requirements. I mean, obviously, we tried to do this in a way to maintain the research value and the integrity of the archive, and that's that was and always will be a difficult balancing act, and I think Jim is probably going to address that somewhat in his guidelines. I'm going to end my presentation and turn it over to Linda now.
Hello. I'm Linda Edgerly, and I work for the Winthrop Group. We're a small consulting firm. We provide information and archival services for corporations, not-for-profit organizations, family-held businesses, sometimes private individuals, so it's a fairly wide range of clients. And over the years that I've been involved in this case, I've been asked to talk primarily about the experience that would be relevant to this circumstance, drawn from the work that we've done with our corporate clients. Although not-for-profits also face some of these same concerns, and in fact, recently, as a result of having seen this session listed in the program, a colleague and I are going to have been asked to do a workshop for a not-for-profit organization that's facing some of these same circumstances, and we've agreed to do that. And this same matter came up this morning at the Business Archives section. So in a way, you may feel as if you're part of a practice run for what could very well become a session that, if it does come to fruition as the discussion moves forward, would take place in Norway in 2008 with the ICA Business and labor organization that's part of ICA. And, of course, it's a much more intricate matter because many, many corporations today are facing these mergers and acquisitions on a global scale, and that means you're also dealing with the issues of records in multiple languages, in resident organizations that will remain operative within the countries of origin, where there are different regulations that may affect them, where there are labor issues to bring the labor part into this, labor issues that affect what you have to retain, and also where you're facing the same kinds of complexities that that will emerge as you try to reach out to different audiences, different publics, and different consumer entities within the organization and within the countries where you're operating. So you can see that this represents, both in the terms of the labor and the business sector, a very complex circumstance. The first exposure that I had to this matter of mergers really came some while ago when I became aware of how rapidly over the years the banking industry had, in fact, gone from having many, many small banks, many of them in tiny communities where banking entities had been formed and had suddenly been acquired as the banking and regulation situation changed. And as a result, even today, we're still dealing with corporations where this continues to be a major concern. I see people sitting in this audience who are, I know, are holding very valuable records, actually, of merged entities where in some cases, the only record that exists of these is in the corporate archives in these various environments. Ken is sitting there with records, I know, of Pacific Northwest logging companies, railroad companies, and things such as the logging entities that were part of the old Pacific Northwest and the development of the industry in the Pacific Northwest and the timber, people who are dealing with banking entities or consumer products companies. And in many cases, that means that the local historical societies do not have these records. And so many corporate archives are holding the history of these communities in corporate collections. And to the extent that these corporations continue to have a relevance to these various communities, they are essential to maintaining the historical information of that community, the development of that business, in some cases the very labor unions and so on that that were part of the development of the industry itself. The key, it seems to me, to addressing these issues of merged, the records of merged entities and acquired companies probably are two. One is to bring to any work that is involved the highest degree of professionalism and care that can possibly be mustered, and probably equivalent to that is a very strong need to tolerate the kinds of ambiguities that arise when mergers take place. You mentioned, I think, that the last people to know about a merger between two unions are the archivists. Well, I'll tell you, it's no different in the corporate sector at all. And in fact, suddenly there's a notice that this is happening, and you're dealing with a situation that is as widespread as you can imagine. So the whole web of responsibilities can be quite tangled and quite difficult to sort out. Just to cite a couple of examples that would maybe help you to understand all of this, that with the stroke of a pen, despite whatever research may have been gone into the acquisition or the decision to make a merger or an acquisition, those inventories of plants and product and accounts payable, receivable, and all of those things that are part of the investment evaluation process to my knowledge, almost never includes any reference at all to the historical record. It's very rare that that happens. I have heard of a couple where they are referenced in the merger agreement, but I would say that if anything, that's the exception by a long shot rather than the rule. And so you find yourself in situations where, for instance, years ago when Chemical Bank in New York, which had had a really quite a vibrant archives program, suddenly found itself in a situation where even though it was the acquiring bank in a merger with Manufacturers Hanover, the professional archivist at Chemical was given 2 weeks' notice that her program was closing down and she should be ready to walk out the door. And Manufacturers Hanover, which was the acquired bank, would nevertheless continue on with an archival program which they didn't even have. This also came into a more complicated process when this whole entity came back together as part of Bank One, which later was acquired by what was then a merger between Bank One, J.P. Morgan, and now J.P. Morgan Chase, which you all may be familiar with. As it turns out, there again, Chase was the acquired bank, and yet it had, at that point, the most professional and the most vibrant of the programs. And fortunately, in this case, it did survive. Now the archivists at Chase Manhattan Bank find themselves, find themselves responsibility for what I believe is something over 800 different merged and acquired entities that are represented. And these records include the old First Chicago Bank, which had a very active program and a very, very active archives at one time. Records of J.P. Morgan, 500 cubic feet of which are at the Morgan Library in New York. The records of the old Chemical Bank, which ended up in a windowless warehouse out in New Jersey somewhere, with a finding aid, which fortunately was able to be brought back together. I mean, you can see this range of things is just astronomical. And in some cases, even the bank, a small bank in Springfield, Illinois, which held some records of Abraham Lincoln. And so suddenly they're talking about this issue of, well, how do we do this? Well, of course, we're going to centralize the records of all of these entities in New York. Are you going to go to Springfield and tell the people in Springfield that they can't have the records of Abraham Lincoln? I don't think so. So, you know, there are all these issues that are extremely complex and difficult to deal with, and that means that an archivist in this situation has to both confront the issues that relate to public relations, community relations, local history and scholarly interests, the regulatory environment, where the resources are in terms of geography, and where you can convince people to give you the assets that you need to take care of these materials. So the issue of centralization versus decentralization will continue to be a real problem. I know that there are several people here in the room who've dealt with the global economy and the acquisition of companies, and I know that Procter & Gamble is one you're all familiar with. After all, it's the largest consumer products company in the world and now has interests in probably, I don't know, how many countries in the world does P&G have? Okay, that gives you some idea, which means that there are records scattered literally globally. The staff at the archives at P&G confronts this issue all the time. Do you leave those records where they are? Are there resources to take care of them where they are? Is there a staff that can manage them? Is there support in the country where they are to make them available, to preserve them, to make sure that they're well cared for? In some cases, P&G has left very active archival programs in place. In some cases where there was no archives, they have been able to bring materials to Cincinnati and incorporate them in the corporate archives. In some cases, they have actually gone about establishing an active archive program to take care of materials where they can be used by the people who need them. And these records document everything from intellectual property and important branding to the research and development that is done within a country or a particular environment. So as I said, you really have to look at the issues that relate to both professionalism, ethics, sensitivity to management, regulatory issues, various country requirements in terms of moving records from one place to another, and so on. I think that perhaps a one thing that I haven't touched on but is worth thinking about is a circumstance that arose quite some while ago and actually had a very interesting and valuable outcome, one that is worth considering in some kinds of situations. You may be familiar with the fact that the J. Walter Thompson Archives was transferred to a not-for-profit organization at a time in which everyone sort of couldn't understand why that was happening, and of course it had to do with a combination of interests from the English entity of J. Walter Thompson, the U.S. entity, and the archivist in that case was given about 6 months' notice that the archives in New York was going to close, and I have always had my hat off to Cynthia because she did a masterful job of basically eliminating her own job and making arrangements for a transfer of the whole archive of J. Walter Thompson to the Hartman Center at Duke University, where the J. Walter Thompson Archive became sort of a crown jewel of the collection there. And that archive continues to operate as a very well-used collection, both by the public and by J. Walter Thompson, the successor organization of J. Walter Thompson, and has become a very important element of study for people who look at the role of advertising in the evaluation of our consumer products and industry packaging and the presentation of consumer products in our society. And so I think that in any case where you're dealing with either labor records or corporate records, having this various set of opportunities available to you is important, and it may even be that eventually we have to look at circumstances in which it could very well evolve that corporations ultimately even become one of the important repositories for labor records, and may very well mean that sometime, despite the fact that we may say this could never have happened, the potential for some kind of collaboration between business and labor just to preserve the histories of both the labor and industry may be a very valuable tool for us. So for those who are confronted with this from one position or another, whether it's from a local historical perspective, from a standpoint of a collecting repository, a not-for-profit organization, or a corporate entity, I think that having these various potential opportunities in place may ultimately offer a number of openings for people to look at, and that kind of flexibility will ultimately lead to a greater result than any one of these, you know, formalized solutions could ever offer us. And I think that that's one of the most important pieces to bring to this kind of consideration. Thank you.
Okay. Does anyone want to jump in with a response?
You wanted to go back, Jim?
Excuse me. I think particularly part of the value of this session is to sort of build bridges between business and labor. While there are a lot of differences, and I have originally a lot of trepidation about this, about the application of a business model in guiding labor archives as the model for how to handle mergers. But I do think there's a lot of benefit to building these bridges, that there are some common features in merger activity, but also with eyes open about the differences of the particular cultures of each. One of the areas I'm a little bit concerned about is with respect to the different nature of corporate archives. You can't apply a monolith model to each group in a way. Through this talk, I've understood the diversity of corporate collections. And in my repository, we also have business collections, although some of them are mostly finite as opposed to ongoing concerns. But in terms of appraisal and documentation strategies with regard to the differences between labor archives and business archives, a lot has to do with how we reference and what is our public service mission. I don't think you can all say that all corporate collections are closed because you're eliminating business collections, which may be held in academic institutions. But that's one concern or one area of bridging that we might have to think about in terms of our respective people who we reference and provide reference service to. We provide our reference service to our union clients as well as to the public. we get these collections and they're open. One concern I may have about applying a business model would possibly be having sort of closed collections or restrictions on certain groups of records that in terms of how how we would deal with that. But I do think there are a lot of common features that you brought out where we do have a commonality of interest to do that. And I think building this towards the business and labor section and getting some representation internationally and to work towards this issue. And I think this session's been very beneficial to bridging that.
I just say another, couple of words, because in the last several weeks, there has actually, in the Bank of America and BNA case, there has been some discussions, essentially doing what Linda held up as the model for J. Walter Thompson and Duke, and there's been some discussions about those records being transferred to the Hagley Museum and Library in Wilmington, which creates there's a certain advantage to that. One, it maintains the local context of this story, and also in terms of the business history story, this is a very important story about the history of banking and credit card industry in the late 20th century. So it sort of opens that up in terms of business history research. Again, as I said, the last chapter has not been written about that, but that option is at least on the table, and that's again something that was also in the back of our mind as we were doing this reappraisal, because one of the things we were also thinking about is that ultimately this might be the way this would end up, and we were sort of thinking about the business history literature as we went through this process of reappraisal.
But the problem with that is that if you move that whole collection to Hagley, that means you end up with the Fleet Bank records, which are Boston.
No, we're just talking about the MBNA.
The MBNA only, yeah. I see. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Not that, yeah.
Yeah, Maureen, the Fleet Bank records, are they down in Charlotte now? They've been moved down to Charlotte. Yeah.
That's a good example.
3,000
Right.
And Paul Revere.
Right. Oh, I know. That's
the major Bank of America data company.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I mean, it's
MBNA right now.
It's been really painful for the people in Boston to see those things. Just.
But they are being made available.
Actually, aren't we supposed to?
We should.
We were told that.
Yep.
It's too late now, but for.
I couldn't find that repeat.
Yeah.
We were supposed to pass that out so people could talk into the mic.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Sorry about that.
I find the politics, going back to that, very interesting. I think there's a lot to learn from the corporate archivist in handling mergers. So I don't mean to differentiate, our fundamental role and technique. But one of the things that we'll see how it changes, and I have no answers for this, but the unions that we collect are very zealous about their role. For example, I could not go to corporations until literally a couple years ago and ask for funding. That was like going to the other side. And what you always have to remember is that when you have union records and corporate records, they are two different sides of the bargaining table and will remain that way in the near future. Now, I think, having said that, the labor movement's changing. Right now, the UAW, for example, is going through some intensive negotiations with the Big Three. And the Big Three automakers are in trouble, and the UAW is going to have to, in my opinion, and I think the UAW leadership, if they were candid, would tell you the same thing, they're going to have to give a little. But still, there's one of the things I have to keep in mind is, sort of protecting that, and I don't mean discriminating against researchers, because if anyone wants to give a collection to the Reuther, it's open to the public, plain and simple. If a union does not want to follow those guidelines, that their records are going to be open for the public, then we really don't want them. That's our mission on it. On the other hand, to start taking in corporate records, and put them next to the labor records. There's still this kind of divide. And I'm just tossing this out here. I'm not saying this is an answer to anything or this is going to be written in stone for the future. But it makes a bit of a difference as I was listening to how it operates. Not so much in our core mission of collecting these records and managing them, but that's the certain sort of political influence on the labor side that we have to be very careful about. Otherwise, our collections go bye-bye. So, for what it's worth.
It was mentioned, the ICA section on business and labor was mentioned a couple of times, and even in the blurb, the description for this session, it was mentioned. And I'm active in, not in that particular section, but in ICA in general. But it seems to me that the business side of SBL, the section on business and labor, tends to dominate that section. And even though Hans Naes, who is the chair of that section now, as he's talked about, I think he talked to you, Jim, about setting up a separate labor section. And I think it's the European context that's important to see there, because the labor movement in Europe is a lot more socialist than this labor movement. I think I think that keeps labor groups out of that section of ICA. And so I don't know whether if there would be the same sort of dominance would happen in this context.
Well, can I address that? One of the issues involved with that is that we're kind of seeing with the globalization issues that we're moving more towards not a narrow definition of labor in terms of institutional labor unions and the European model of social democracy, but an overall movement linked with human rights and social justice and social action. And so I think the initiative is to move in giving labor a broader context, you know, whether it's a continental model, Pacific Rim model, or anything like that, but that we do get some involvement to at least address these issues, because everything is now global with regard, and I think the labor union is realizing that now. I mean, I know that the United Steelworkers have been very active in crafting statements and agreements with English labor unions in German in the large metalworking federations. And I do think we're starting to move towards the idea, well, domestically it was the mega merger. Now we're moving to global or supra unions, I think, is some of the terminology. But I do think there's this larger social action role, which I think would give us a broader context and maybe more of alignment of what labor sees itself, because it is moving into that, whether it's social action, environmentalism, justice, a lot of initiatives that the larger unions are getting involved in as a broad political spectrum. Just one other thing I wanted to address, because I do think Richard Strasberg is here, and his footprint is somewhat on this session, because I don't want to leave it all that there's a lot of this, you know, the sky's falling type of thing. We do have a lot of complicated issues to address, but, you know, there are some possibilities with digitization and what Mike was talking about, decentralization, the idea that it may be a good thing not, you know, to have everything concentrated in terms of resources, that there's some logic to this. But there are possibilities inherent that are very positive with this in terms of digitization of collections, creating virtual guides to collections to kind of bring this all together, even if we don't all have the physical space to concentrate it. And I think in that it would be very perceptive with business having probably, we're always assuming you guys have a lot more money than us, but there may be a model that we can borrow from business in terms of how it brings together all of these entities, because they have to do it. They're for profits. But I do think that there's a role to play in this in terms of once we get more of these collections online and start sharing, we can virtually bring this together without the headaches of kind of trying to deal with the centralization.
Okay, this is new to me. Hi, my name is Bridget Burke. I just wanted to throw out one other model, and it's one that I experienced in Colorado and is probably not familiar to people west of east of the Mississippi, but Colorado Fuel and Iron Archives, which, you know, are arguably one of the largest corporate archives to become publicly available in a long, long time, about, I don't know, 25,000 linear feet, which were essentially abandoned at the plant in Pueblo. And what has happened out there is really quite fascinating because the community came together and founded something called the Bessemer Historical Society, which is run as a nonprofit group and has taken over this corporate archives that was abandoned by CF&I, which, you know, one time employed 1 out of 10 people in the state of Colorado. And they have been successful in getting some NHPRC grants and in targeting particular, you know, segments of the collection to make available. They are building, hoping to build a museum facility down there. So it's one to watch, I think, because it you don't often see working class neighborhoods taking control of corporate archives, and that is, in fact, what has happened down there. So just wanted to mention that one.
Does it include some of the labor union materials as well?
Well, no. Yes and no. There are labor-related files. There are strike-related
right.
files. There are also, if you're aware of CF&I, you know, the people who brought you Ludlow, there are extensive medical records, mm-hmm. which are really problematic because each one of those index cards contains medical information, but it also contains this really amazing demographic information about number of children and language spoken at home and, you know, educational level. Includes extensive photographic material, but it also includes, for example, the patterns used in steelmaking. So there's a kind of realia aspect to it as well. And a lot of information on the company towns that CF&I ran right. in that area.
I mean, that's a wonderful thing, really, because, I mean,
amazing.
Any researcher who comes in needs to have both sides of the story. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that also reflects the larger researcher trend that's occurred over the last 10 to 15 years of working class studies versus studying institutional unions. Now, I still think there are plenty of avenues for research into the institutional union network, but still, things like that, that's great to hear. And especially with the working class coming up like that, you're right. I think that is very rare, a very rare occurrence. But that, and I think that also speaks to the whole changing nature of what we do, and that it may indeed be a time when the unions and the corporations could merge their records for a historical segment. I don't see it in the near future, but you never know. You never know.
Just picking up on that thought, yeah, actually, there are very similar trends in business history. Business historians also are not doing the institutional history of the firms the way they used to do in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. They're more interested now in the social history of business, technology, and society. So in terms of breaking down these institutional barriers, in terms of the scholarship on the business history side, also there's sort of a logic to that in terms of the research trends.
Yeah, because it also, just in general, if you don't mind one last word on it, which we haven't addressed at all. I mean, we're just thinking as archivists, how do you preserve the records, right? This is our number one mission in life. On the other hand, you always have to keep the researchers in mind. And things have changed, the researcher trends have changed dramatically. In terms of use of our collections over the last few years. And I think it will continue to change because of, one, just plain subject interest, and second, as you pointed out, the different means of conveying this information that we have, which, you know, the web, YouTube, you name it.
A comment and a question. We, too, have the records of 13.
Can you say your name? They asked.
Richard Strasberg. I'm the director of the Kiel Center at Cornell. There is I don't know if it's unique to unions, but there is what I call the strange bedfellow phenomena in union mergers, where two unions who have fought each other like tigers suddenly, because of economic necessity, find themselves in the same boat, linking ship, perhaps, as it were. And the problem for archivists comes from the fact that there is a winner and a loser to typically in these mergers. A weaker partner and a stronger partner. And consequently, this frequently the stronger partner doesn't give a toot, to be polite about it, about the history of its enemy, its former enemy. That shouldn't be the way it is, but in my experience, that often is the way it is. And that's something that archivists, labor archivists, maybe business archivists too, have to deal with.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy, that's just a comment. My question has to do with electronic records during mergers. I hope that businesses, I know that businesses are more sophisticated about the need to preserve electronic records, I certainly hope so, than some of our unions are. And e-discovery has come at as a bitter discovery to a lot of our labor unions who, the good news is they start paying a lot of attention to records management. But I'd like to hear comments on the merger of these organizations and the preservation of their electronic records. And I hope that businesses do it better than unions do.
Well, I think that we're still dealing with a fairly recent, you know, because most archives still don't have a major responsibility in some of these instances for a huge body of electronic records. But what has really affected this more than anything else is the fact that within the last, 7 or 8 years, the cost of maintaining everything has dropped so phenomenally that people are not making a lot of selections about what they need to retain and what they don't. What is happening is that what's making that decision about what gets retained in a merger situation primarily has to do with whether or not the systems are maintained over time to continue to provide access to those records. And I did actually, in preparation for this session, go back to the security lawyers' handbook on, you know, on what do the mergers, what do they face when they're dealing with a merger. And there is a, I can't remember how many pages there are of the table of contents for this handbook, but of that table of contents, 5 single space pages deal with the records of mergers and acquisitions. So you can imagine that since many, many of those are in electronic format because they deal with everything from securities to the records that have to be maintained, you can bet that a good portion of those are just everything is being kept and people aren't making selections about it at this stage. Whether there will be the discipline over time to go back and make some steps that will guarantee the preservation of those past the period of time that would be required to meet the various regulatory bodies' requirements and SARBOX and all of that, I think we remain to see. And archivists are going to have a real battle on their hands, I think. I don't know that any of us has any notion about how complex that's going to be. Because of the fact that right now, everything is, you know, everything's up for grabs, and we haven't got to a point where there's decision making required in many instances.
But there's an upside and a downside to
yeah.
that. Yes, we have our hands full. You know, again, on the business archive side, maintaining compliance with these laws that nobody quite understands what they mean and what the scope is. On the other hand, as you said, just the fact that these laws are in place, it means that people need to pay attention to these issues of records retention, because we all have the horror stories in front of us what happens when this is not done, and there's, you know, a huge potential liability if this is not done carefully. So we're obviously in somewhat uncharted terrain, but for the archival world, this is not necessarily a bad thing. Actually, in my experience, on balance, this has actually helped us in terms of maintaining our our programs, because there's a real business and legal need that could be demonstrated.
I think this is, it's an excellent question. It's something we're grappling with all the time, because I think it's had some detrimental effects for us, very detrimental. One is because of Oxley-Sorbane and others, other incidents and the general ideology of the national administration over the last 7 years, unions, I'll just speak for the ones I deal with, they're very wary of electronic records. Not for preservation purposes. I mean, we all know what a nightmare is coming on that, migrating information down the line, make sure electronic records are stored. Our problem is, one, the unions I deal with will not give you email, period. In fact, Service Employees International Union, for example, this is the largest, if you don't count the National Education Association, this is the largest union in the country and growing, about 1.8 million members. All their email throughout the SEIU is trashed after 60 days. We will have none of the correspondence in the future. And indeed, the second step is actually physically going to their offices, trying to deal with usually the Secretary Treasurer's office, in setting up any kind of electronic protocols to have even the basic things such as newsletters or journals or a snapshot of the website given to us. It's very hard to have them with the program. Now, the only good part of it is, it's at least on the labor side, it's a bit of a reprieve, because we're still getting lots of paper, and so we're not too worried at this point, but somewhere in the next couple of years there's going to be a break point where the paper dries up, we start hitting the 21st century, and I'm not even sure what we're going to be able to collect. And this goes back to my point about, I personally think archivists need to be to document. Change to Win, for example. We're going to collect Change to Win. Can I be assured that 5 years from now electronic records will come our way? No. And so what our archivist who deals with Change to Win is doing is literally getting Google alerts, downloading speeches, downloading materials, and creating something that we probably wouldn't consider 20 years ago, artificial collections. And I think that in the future, archivists are going to move way away from paper and all the methodology that surrounds paper into more documentary strategies along these lines, as well as a different, which also relates to access in terms of producing more for the web, even things like videos for the web and all kinds of online databases. And I think an archivist is going to, their roles are going to change tremendously in dealing with the labor union records.
Really quick, you had mentioned a handbook that you said you looked at. Can you just repeat what were you talking about? A proprietary handbook or what?
No, it's you can look it up on the web. That there are resources like this available. It's the Security Lawyers Handbook on mergers and let's see. I'm sorry to say I can't give the exact citation, but there is a group of security lawyers, and they deal primarily with the issues that surround Securities and Exchange Commission and the other regulatory bodies that handle securities law, and it does identify certain kinds of records that need to be maintained, and records retention guidelines are included in that that handbook. So it's possible to look up these things. If you are an archivist, you can. I had not stopped to look at it myself until getting ready for this session, and then I'm suddenly going through this, five pages of just the table of contents before I even turn to the actual handbook itself. It's fairly complex, and a lot of it's pretty arcane. But if you're thinking about the issues that surround mergers and what you have to do if you're documenting some kind of a merger, and this would probably apply to other kinds of entities as well. It's not a bad thing to know about if you have archival responsibilities in this area, and some of them may very well apply, I suspect, to other entities like labor unions, because after all, they are corporate entities, and even though they don't have stock offerings, they still have a
Yeah, members.
Yeah, right.
So it's those kinds of resources are readily available, and you can do a lot of searching on the web and get information about this. So it's a great resource if you need it.
Hi, just a quick comment. A colleague received an announcement last month on an H Business newsletter, Listler, about an upcoming conference in January in Japan on the long view of mergers and acquisitions. So there might be something of interest for people in this group as a result of the papers from that conference.
Who is sponsoring it?
It's a Japanese university. It's an organization. I think it was Waseda, but I don't recall the name. And it came across an H Business listserv. So it's in January 2008.
I just wanted to make sure to go back to Michael's introductory comments about his work with the archives, indicating that with Bank of America Archives. I just did want to qualify that our work has always been with MBNA archives and never with Bank of America archives. So the work that we've done, it's always been, it's now termed the legacy MBNA archives, but we've never put hands on other Bank of America records. So just wanted to clarify that.
Is that because that was what you were hired to do, or because you didn't have access to them? Okay.
With MBNA and never Bank of America, and that was the project that was our responsibility.
Actually, I'd like to make one other comment, picking up on what Mike said before, because in fact, the regulatory requirements in terms of records retention are pretty similar in terms of business and labor. And one of the things, you know, when I've been, you know, talking to many of the labor unions, is also to make them conscious of what the regulatory requirements are. And particularly given, this may be sort of a backhanded way to get into this, but particularly given some of the new regulations and the enforcement that the Bush administration, because they're so hostile to labor unions, are, reading the regulations very strictly in terms of the Landrum-Griffin Act, that in fact there are some real cases where they, you know, many of the labor unions have also faced severe liability for destroying email. There was one case involving a hotel and restaurant workers in New York where they were held in contempt of court because they had destroyed email. And this is one of the things that when you bring up, they also understand that there's reasons to be managing these records in a responsible way, not to maintain an historical record, but they do understand that they are under increased scrutiny by a hostile administration in Washington, and they have to be in compliance with the law.
Yeah, that goes with financial record, membership data, election, which is always a hot topic of concern. Mm-hmm. But also in a new area with regard to reporting on political action work, right, which is extremely sensitive among labor unions, because they see that as the major avenue of redress to take back the impediments to organizing and particularly campaign drives to register members.
We have about 5 more minutes.
I was thinking about from the, this maybe more because I came from public archives into private archives, but from the public relations side, this is a real small example. I know we've got minute books from a 19th century Pennsylvania paper mill company, and we bought the company that had bought that company. We've since long sold the property of that mill, and now we've sold that whole line of business. And I just kind of came across these minute books and thought, the likelihood anyone's going to know we've got them would be a truly intrepid researcher would have to figure that out. So I'm wondering if corporations have tried to leverage that by returning those records to either the local or state historic society. On the other hand, then that means I've got to deal with the law department, the corporate secretary, and public relations. And I've got a lot of backlog to deal with, so even identifying this stuff. And just a comment, too, being the last people to hear about acquisitions. And in selling that major business line, nobody's come to us and said, you know, we want those records, or when we buy, we've got to go out and track down the records if we want them. So, yeah, law department doesn't tell us. But maybe I guess my question is really about the public relations aspect, if it's
that,
worth it. Really.
That's the old fine paper. Is that the old fine paper business that was near Philly and also up in Fitchburg, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are some situations where corporations actually have used the return of records to a community for PR purposes and have actually been able to leverage that into a community effort to kind of reconstruct community history. The problem is that in a lot of these cases, these local historical societies don't want these records back because they don't have the resources to take care of them either, which means, right, which means that you end up with these collections like that where you have those records from Pennsylvania, Western Massachusetts, for instance, that are way out in the Pacific Northwest, and so the question is whether you could, I mean, you know, what's in it for Weyerhaeuser? Not much, really. So it's really a matter of whether there's some other way that you could leverage that in, you know, in some sort of community relations program. I don't know that there is. And moreover, is that local historical society say, well, you want to give these back to us? Well, why don't you give us the money to help take care of them then? And I think that's another problem that a lot of corporations face in trying to take that tack is, you know, is are there resources in situ where you could, you know, put those records safely and they'd be cared for? It might apply to all sorts of things like land records, you know, old plat books, things like that. Or we came across some records with one of the banks where there were these wonderful, beautiful maps that had been drawn of investments in various neighborhoods and so on, where literally every single building was identified with the trade or the function that was going on at that particular time in those books. And, you know, to find somebody who wants to take them is a major job. I mean, it really, that means the corporation has to be prepared to spend the money to take those old merged records and figure out where they can be. And that's an act of community responsibility, I guess. You could say that there's something in that if you can figure out a way to do it. Maybe archivists can help with that. I mean, that actually would be, I mean, archivists tend to be very collaborative anyway. So archivists have often said, well, gee, I know so-and-so might be interested in this and informally will take those steps. So there may be some things that can be done even without, you know, without it. Yeah, it's a little different with minute books. That may be a different issue because you've got corporate, you know, corporate secretary responsibilities.
Well, I think we've run out of time, but Linda, just mentioning the collaborative natural instinct of archivists, I just wanted to thank everybody, whether you're from labor archives or business archives or from a public institution, for being here and participating because, I mean, the comment was made earlier that, you know, it is a challenge to brainstorm the idea of business and labor archives coming together on all aspects. I mean, it's not a natural collaboration, but I think just informing each other of what our common and different issues are when it comes to mergers or other record custodian issues, I think is important. And I just wonder, you know, are there other possibilities for us to continue to come together this way and talk? I mean, if SAA is a conduit for that, you know, I'm happy to be a participant in that in the future. So if there aren't any final comments, I guess we can say thank you and wrap up. Okay.
Okay, we survived. Yeah. Reasonably well.